depression, beating up journalists, and bird dogging on a national scale. I'm Justin Katz, and this is Last Impressions, number 17. So I've been catching up with things in my schedule. I mean, I've been complaining a lot, I know, recently about not being able to get things done. Some things are getting down, but, you know, I don't know if it's the weather or what, but lately I've been feeling kind of down, you know, how that goes. Sometimes when you get through the woods of being busy, you don't realize that it was the busyness that was kind of keeping you going. And that sort of made it timely for the passing and the suicide of Chris Cornell of the Seattle grunge band Soundgarden. Rich Larson, who writes on his website, the first 10 words kind of gave it some perspective. Why in particular Chris Cornell? Now Cornell obviously is sort of the second to last of the big Seattle grunge vocalists to go. I mean, you had obviously Kurt Cobain, and also Layne Staley of Alice in Chains. So that's two of the biggies. Another big biggie was Soundgarden, and Chris Cornell is now gone. That leaves Eddie Vedder of Pearl Jam. So I hope somebody's dragged him to a doctor, as I said last week. Rich Larson on the first 10 words talks about how Cornell was different from the others in a way. He had a different style, he played a different role, sort of more of the sort of the statesman as far as, you know, grunge rockers go. And so there's something that really hit Larson about this particular one. And let me read you a bit of his post here. Cornell is speaking to us all one last time. This isn't something we left behind in our 20s. This isn't something cured by age or financial security. This isn't something you outgrow. If it's allowed to fester, depression is stronger than wisdom. Depression is insidious and tenacious. Depression can get to anybody. It can make you feel like an old man at 27. It can make you feel like a lost child at 52. And so his point there is well taken. I think a lot of people go into something like music and try to become rock stars for some kind of affirmation. And I think a lot of the problems we see in stars, celebrities, is that you don't actually get it. Just being rich and famous doesn't provide whatever it was they were looking for. Now, obviously, for a lot of them, it does. That's why the depressed ones and the suicides and such are kind of notable. But they're more than, say, the average person in society that you might know. Stars seem to need something, and wealth and fame doesn't give it to them. So, you know, being a rock star, growing up to be an adult, finally having a family, as Cornell did, that doesn't end the doldrums, the depression. It's kind of like, I mean, this is superficial, I guess, but it's kind of like tinnitus. You know, the ringing in your ears from when you've listened to too much loud grunge music. I mean, sometimes you don't really notice it, you don't really hear it, but it's always there. And whenever you get to feeling like, okay, maybe it's faded finally, at some point it just comes right back, and you're sitting there and you hear that ringing in your ears, or you feel that depression. Now, of course, the Larson doesn't raise to me the really. Yeah, he says depression is stronger than wisdom. The cure, I think, ultimately is faith and having that broader perspective, that source of meaning. You know, people who focus on the clinical side of life, or the material and medical matters, I think they see things like depression as entirely biological, chemical. You know, you can work on ways to get away from it, but it's always there. You can't beat it. Same thing with addiction and that sort of thing. You know, I think in a large part that's wrong. I think our chemicals obviously come into play, and our biology comes into play with how we feel and how we interact with the world. But it's a two-way street. So you can you can do things that create the chemicals, or you can succumb to the chemicals that they have for whatever, just a surge that has nothing to do with what you're experiencing in your life. But I think I've found the single biggest bulwark, the best wall, the best protection against depression is to have the substantive reach of faith. And if that faith isn't in part of a tradition or in a specific particular church with rules and practices and rituals, then those become a method of getting back on track. But you can't always, I mean, you still have the moments of resurgent sadness, and even when it feels like there's no reason for it, and even though you know you can get out of it with the right perspective. If nothing else, faith helps you make the decision, I'm going to work my way out of this right now. And I think that's because I believe in something bigger. And I think that's really important. But world events and things in your life obviously can make you depressed. As much as I'd hate to say it, that might be part of the reason I've been feeling down recently, is just the constant frustrating wrangling and fighting, and this feeling that we're you have to pick a side, we're all divided, we can't just work together to get somewhere. One massive side of our society has to beat another massive side or be defeated. There's that sense, and we're all quickly going into our corners, and that really in the past couple of days has been emphasized in the news by this situation where a GOP congressional candidate in Montana, Greg Gianforte, apparently attacked a Guardian, Ben Jacobs, who's a reporter for The Guardian, at least at the moment. He's written for a lot of other mainstream, left-leaning, and Guardian's more than leaning, but publications. And so I guess Gianforte was about preparing to give an interview to Fox News, and Jacobs came in and tried to ask questions, and Gianforte knocked him down. Let's put it that way for this point of the podcast. here's an audio clip that Jacobs immediately released, proclaiming that he had been body slammed. And so for last night anyway, this was really all we had to go on.
Into the CBO score, because you know you were waiting to make your decision about healthcare until you saw the bill and it just came out.
And what we'll talk to you about that later.
Yeah, but there's not going to be time. I'm just curious if you have
to speak with Shane, please.
But you don't.
I'm sick and tired of you guys. The last time you came here, you did the same thing. Get the hell out of here. Get the hell out of here. The last guy did the same thing. You were the Guardian?
Yes, and you just broke my glasses.
The last guy did the same damn thing.
You just body slammed me and broke my glasses.
Get the hell out of here.
You'd like me to get the hell out of here, I'd also like to call the police. Can I get you guys' names?
Hey, you gotta leave.
He just body slammed me.
You gotta leave.
So yeah, that does sound bad. Dramatic. But again, it's just audio, so you don't really know if it's just the two people, and Gianforte's people came out and downplayed it, made it sound like he was frustrated and tried to grab the journalist recorder, and it became a scuffle and they both fell down. And so those were the two stories going out there. And it was frustrating to watch happen, because you could immediately, instantly, throughout the journalistic Twitterverse, whatever they were calling it these days, was the assumption that Jacobs was telling the complete truth and that there's no justification for ever losing your temper with a journalist. And two, his characterization that it was a body slam. I mean, a body slam, especially if you grew up in the era of professional wrestling, back when they were still able to call it a WWF, body slam is picking somebody up, maybe even over your head, and slamming them down on the ground. So that there's there was a lot of room for it to not be body slamming. But that was his characterization. Upon getting up, Jacob said, you body slammed me and broke my glasses. So if you're watching the suddenly it became a thing, body slamming journalists, even though the only evidence was so far was this recording and then the statement from the campaign, which were substantially different. Of course, this morning, one of the Fox News reporters, Alicia Acuna, published a summary of her having seen it, of what she saw. And that clarified a lot and made it not quite as ambiguous as it had seemed. So here's a couple paragraphs from her report. She writes, during that conversation, her conversation with Gianforte, another man, who we now know is Ben Jacobs of The Guardian, walked into the room with a voice recorder, put it up to Gianforte's face, and began asking if he had a response to the newly released Congressional Budget Office report on the American Health Care Act. Gianforte told him he would get to him later. Jacobs persisted with his question. Gianforte told him to talk to his press guy, Shane Scanlon. At that point, Gianforte grabbed Jacobs by the neck with both hands and slammed him into the ground behind him. Faith, Keith, and I watched in disbelief as Gianforte then began punching the reporter. As Gianforte moved on top of Jacobs, he began yelling something to the effect of, I'm sick and tired of this. So that's Alicia Acuna, Fox News. Now, let's stipulate that candidates should not be attacking journalists, no matter how annoying they may be. That's part of the job, especially when you go into politics. But we don't learn from these situations unless we consider why they happened, why this one happened, and why people on both sides responded as they did. Based on limited information. And even now, it'll be actually really interesting to see if this hurts Gianforte's campaign. I think the vote's today, maybe tomorrow. And it'll be very interesting to see whether this helps or hurts. I mean, part of the issue was that his race was already closer than people had projected it would be. So this is not a small tangential matter far out from an election. We're right on top of the vote. And it was a close race. And it's going to play into the whole narrative about whether Trump has coattails and all that kind of thing. So now, if we're trying to figure out how and why this is happening, and we have to look at all the perspectives. And we'll give each side its full due. Now, the best point of view I can think of for the journalist, excuse me, for Jacobs is... All right, so he's trying to get a story. He's tired of politicians' obstruction. In fact, last night somebody sent me a tweet of his from a few days ago complaining about the Democrat in the race running away from him. You're this journalist. The election's coming up. He needs the story. He probably has some bias, and there's probably some element of a gotcha. But that's how he's entering this room. Here's a candidate available. I'm going to go get a statement for my story. Now, from the candidate's perspective, he said somebody else has done this to him before and implied it was also another reporter from The Guardian. So it seems to mean somebody else had already accosted him in the middle of another interview or in some space set aside for something else. So he's got these reporters coming after him with this bias, with this gotcha attitude, while he's about to have an interview with somebody else, in this case, presumably modestly friendly Fox News. And here comes this Guardian journalist with his questions, won't go away. He said, he asked him a couple times nicely, all right, come on, stop. And he kept going. You can see how one guy's incentive to get the story, the other's frustration with this behavior boils over. Physical attacks shouldn't happen, but it does. Okay, so you can see how that gets there, and then you can see in the public the reactions of the both sides. I would say the reaction of the journalists on the left are, in some ways, collegial. I don't want to say tribal, but I will. Apt to believe each other and sympathize with their professional peers. On the other hand, among conservative, say Trump-ish Americans, there's this huge distrust of the press. And, you know, it looks convenient that this reporter interjected himself into the story in a close election, in a campaign season in which the news media has to a huge, you know, if you don't like to hear this, I'm sorry, but to a huge degree, just joined the Democrats in hoping for signs of a Republican downfall and wanting to bring down the president. And then it wasn't helped by the fact that journalists jumped right into Twitter and I'm sure elsewhere, jumped right on a story from the beginning, not only taking, you know, just one version of the events at face value, but also instantly making it an anti-Trump, anti-Republican thing. And then not contrasting it with, the mainstream didn't contrast it with this escalating violence from the left on campuses and elsewhere. That was not lost on conservatives. So this is how we get to this point of divergence. Now, I don't want to undersell how inappropriate it is to attack people, not just journalists, anybody. But that's so obvious. This is one of those things where it's so obvious that it's not the interesting question. I guess if your goal is to tar an entire political party, then you want to make it about the attack rather than, you know, allowing us all to say we all agree on that thing. So let's put that aside. The question that's more important, because it's not so obvious, more critical to address at this time, because it's not asked as often and because it's not so obvious, is where are our boundaries for journalists? You know, it's a serious question. I think a lot of people in the public would like to know, what are your rules? At what point is a journalist not just gathering information and instead is making themselves part of the story and trying to affect the outcome? Now you can have sympathy for that when they're trying to find the reporting on some homeless person or a sick child, trying to get people to respond and help that person. But in a political framework, where are the boundaries? I mean, is there some limit to the lengths that they should go for a statement? You know, do not go pounding on the guy's door at midnight. Do not sneak into his bathroom with your recorder trying to get a quote. When if he's giving an interview to somebody else, do you kind of wait a moment? Should there be a number of times where, you know, let's address this later? No. How about talk to my press guy? No. I mean, should there be some? Could there be a safe word? You know, like pineapples, and that just means, you know, look, you're at a brink here. But this was even more. I mean, so you have different reporters from the same arguably ideological newspaper repeating a similar technique. Is that too far? I'm not saying, you know, I need a handbook for this, but I think if we want to understand why we're having these differences and these battles culturally, these are questions that the general public should probably know the answer to. Are there no boundaries? Are there really the fact that somebody, some newspaper that publishes, even a respectable one, but that has some, should that be a carte blanche to accost people? And you're always after the story. I mean, the guy's not even in office yet, so it's not like he's an elected official with some immediate public responsibility to answer direct questions. He's a candidate, and they're political questions. This wasn't immediate. It wasn't an immediate question like, hey, I need a statement on what just happened outside. This is, you know, I need a statement on the Trump care bill. I mean, he's the reporter in the tape. You could hear him say, oh, there's no time. Well, no, there is time. All right, pal, back off. So I think people need to understand where is that boundary? And without that, you know, it reminds me of James O'Keefe had those videos showing that showing sort of the Democrat operatives fomenting the violence to create the narrative that there was violence in Trump campaigns. And they even had a term for it. It was bird dogging, where you set up and you try to create the circumstances in which somebody on the other side will do something that will catch journalist's eye and make the candidate look bad. It's bird dogging. You go up and you talk smack to some person in the front row, or the back row, trying to, you know, just kneeling him, needle. Come on, hit me. I've seen this happen locally with union officials go up to elected officials, say on a school committee, and get in their face, swinging their arms around like madmen, just trying to get that reaction, that anger, that punch. So it starts, I mean, this case, it doesn't seem like that. And Alicia Kunif, I'm probably pronouncing that wrong too, but from Fox News said there was no aggression. So, you know, and the tape certainly doesn't give any of that impression. It wasn't a prolonged thing. But unless we start to understand each other's boundaries, that's an open question, right? And of course, you know, there's the Trump context. Now, whether it's ideological or for the proverbial story of a lifetime, the news media is trying to take down President Trump. And you don't have to be a major Trump supporter who thinks he can do no wrong to think that that is bad, unhealthy, and ought to stop. And that's contributing to this, too. I mean, now, of course, you know, those of us on the right, we need to refuse to tolerate this sort of attack, stay above the fray, maintain the high ground, because that's ultimately, I think, what conservatives are selling. But I think this incident shows that it's going to get harder. I mean, our society is going to continue this sort of cultural descent into chaos unless the left and the news media give some consideration to what they're doing. Now, obviously, the right does too, but I think it's the aggressor, not in this instance, obviously, but more broadly, is the left. And it makes you wonder if they're trying to bring down the president, and if they're trying to reverse course of the Republican sweeping the legislature and the states, legislatures and executives. If that's their goal, then they don't want them. A lot of them don't want to end this. And I would beseech those who do, who really, they're liberals and progressives in good faith and want to communicate and win hearts and minds, to start being more concerned about the bad behavior on their side. You know, it's almost like we're heading toward a sort of bird dogging on a national scale. Now, I'm not saying that this journalist or these journalists, perhaps from The Guardian, were deliberately engaged in this effort to be attacked or to evoke some bad reaction that would get them a big headline and hurt the candidate in this particular race. I'm not saying that they were doing that, but a lot of the goal of bird dogging, as I understand it, is to create a situation in which other people, just being human, just reacting as people do, will take that next step that's what you want. And it's, in some ways, it seems like the left is creating that condition for the entire country, where it's in the incentives for journalists to be more aggressive with Republicans, and then Republicans are feeling like they have to react, and they're seeing violence elsewhere, and that seems to get a pass because it's from the left. So they start to get frustrated and to push back, and it's just not healthy, bird dogging on a national scale. And it's, like I said, like I started out by saying, it's can be depressing. And part of the problem is if we've got this sense of meaningless in life, this sense of depression, one drug that people can turn to is anger. And one source of meaning that they can turn to is their group and their particular ideological kin. And that is when you really start to get into the dangerous territory on a national scale. And we need to find our shared meaning and start trying to see it from each other's perspectives. And that'll do it for me until next week. Hopefully things cheer up.